Blog Talk Radio.
Number two. Wow. Stop and think about that for a second. Season number two. When I say season, I'm not talking about the seasons that have come along like spring, summer, and the rest of that. I'm talking about season two of what we do here, When Black Men Talk. For the past first season, we've been on Google Podcasts and, of course, Spotify. I want to thank those who are giving us a listen. And if you're just listening for the very first time, welcome to It's When Black Men Talk. It's an opportunity where three gentlemen get together and share a provocative talk from a male perspective on life, love, and relationships. Always shoot for honest self-evaluation and not shying away from some things that need to be said. And sometimes folks do shy away. They want to, you know, kind of be PC. Or they don't want to hurt somebody's feelings. Not us. We just basically say what has to be said from time to time. We've been doing this for a while, even though we're in our second season. I say the second season because the second season of actually being on Google Podcasts and Spotify. But we've been doing this for quite some time. And, you know, interesting, you know, you think you know some folks, and then you realize you may not know folks at all. But then again, you really didn't know them, man, because we first started doing the show, little did I know that my own cousin wanted to come up and beat me just for doing the show. For no other reason, for just doing the show. Just wanted to come up and fight me for this. For just doing the show. I mean, I you know, that's all I did, show up and do the show. But for some reason, he was inclined to want to come up and just, you know, beat a brother down. And then I come to find out recently, Mr. Charles, he only committed to the first two shows. He wasn't even going to be here that long. But I'm thinking that these two young men, you know, even though they didn't want to be here early on, one wanted to beat me up. Years later, you know, week after week, we get together and we put together One Black Man Talk. Yeah, you know by now, this cat's my cousin. You hear him laughing in the background, Mr. D. Maurice. Put the dukes down, bro. No fighting tonight. How you feeling, sir?
You know, it ain't nothing but love, bro. Nothing but love. I'm doing well. I'm doing well.
Oh, man, you're right about that. Nothing but love that we share from time to time, bro. You know, we've been saluting and doing some saluting folks throughout the years. We give people flowers when they can smell them, because a lot of times when people pass, we rush in at that point. We want to say beautiful things about them and give them flowers. Why not give them those flowers when they can smell them? And I have someone I want to salute, but before I salute this individual, I'm going to go back and really salute and honor a man that his name doesn't come up too often, realistically. And such a quiet gentleman, such a quiet gentleman. And he passed maybe about a week ago. I'm speaking of one Hank Aaron. And it's hard to believe that in some form of fashion that you live in the current day time and never heard that name. So I know what he meant to me, you know, and I'm sure he meant something to you. So I'm going to pass it over to you and allow you to speak on one Mr. Hank Aaron.
Hank was the Hammer Hank, and he was a guy who played for the Indianapolis Clowns in the Negro League. And was a player that I felt like never got his just due of really eclipsing Bob Babe Ruth's home run record, and never got the accolades that he deserved. In the baseball world, I think he did, because there was a lot of players, even in different sports, who really, really loved him, really admired him, not only for his excellence on the baseball field, but his excellence as a man of integrity, a man of fighting for civil rights. He was heckled and threatened while he was trying to break the record. And despite it all, he just went through the fire. He just went through the fire. And, you know, I regret that people really didn't get to know him and give him his flowers before he passed away, because he truly deserved it. And he was just a quiet, stoic man when you saw him. And the last time I think I saw him in an interview, ESPN was doing a baseball game, and they interviewed him for, it seemed like forever. It seemed like two or three innings. And just to hear him speak, the commentators were just in awe of just listening to him and asking him questions and just learning from him. And I remember Ms. Mendoza, who works at ESPN, she posted up part of an interview, and I text back. I remember this interview because I didn't even pay attention to the game at that particular point, because it was like sitting at your grandfather's feet, listening to this great man talk about the game he loved and what he used to do. He used to take Coke. He used to order 24 bats, he said, before the season, and he would stroke them down with Coke bottles. And you know that was coming from the Negro League, and like little secrets like that he had, and he had the edge over everybody else. That you were just sitting in amazement of all the knowledge. And I wish that players now, younger players, maybe in college and high school, little league players, really kind of look him up, or wish they had a chance to meet him and to soak up all that knowledge and take that with them in baseball. Because, you know, we talk about that on the sports show, not a lot of black players are in baseball now. But I wish that this kind of sparked something to get more black players in baseball and try to live up to the standard of a Hank Aaron.
It's interesting, man, because I don't even think outside of baseball, a lot of black athletes look at the ones that became for them, how they set the stage for what they're doing now. They're just more concerned about their brand. I remember there was a player from can't think of the cat's name, Mon KC, came out and called LeBron the greatest player or the guy to win championships. And the cat played for the Boston Celtics for a period of time, won a championship with the Boston Celtics, and didn't realize that what Bill Russell did basically in college through the pros, and Bill Russell basically came right back and snapped back like, gentlemen, that's what it was. He said LeBron was the greatest athlete, and then realized that Bill Russell ran track, if I'm not mistaken, and won championships in college.
Yeah, the high jump.
And came
to
the pros. Yes. Yeah. It came to the pros. And I'm going to go back for a moment. Think about the moments or the days when Bill Russell and Hank Aaron played. Imagine doing what you love and people basically hating on you or hating you, saying things that you can't respond to. And you put that all behind you and went out there to perform to the highest of your actual ability and exceeded way beyond the folks that are around you, the level they were playing. So you think about that and think about now with these common day players, they walk out, folks admire them. And if folks say something wrong, then, you know, they acting like big babies. Remember Russell Westbrook went in the league and wanted to go on the stand one time. A guy said something about him. He was ready to charge him. That happened to Bill Russell, Hank Aaron on a daily basis when they played. That's the type of stuff that will overlook into Excel. So I know knock LeBron, I don't like none of them, but they realize what they need to realize is that their bed is so much softer and has so much cushion because gentlemen like Hank Aaron. Mr. Charles, we're talking about Hank Aaron. We're going to salute an individual. We will in a minute or two, but I wanted to get you in because I know you're a big fan of this guy. Hank Aaron, man, you hear the name. He's no longer here. The name itself, Hank Aaron, speaks to you and say what?
Greatness, a hero, even though he never desired to be, but it's what he represented it, what he was representing, should I say. And the one thing to a bridge, a lot of people don't know what I mean by that. When I mean by a bridge, you guys have mentioned earlier that he played in the Negro League. And imagine playing baseball or whatever sport, knowing that some of the players that you played with were some of the greatest athletes in the world, but you didn't receive recognition, true recognition or credit from the mainstream. But in your heart, you knew every time you went out there and you faced a Sasser Page or you went against a Josh Gibson or Jackie Robinson before he broke the Negro League barrier, before he broke the Major League barrier, you knew every night that if we had opportunity to play, man, we would dust them off and they know it too. That bridge is because we were so focused on what happened with the major leagues and how he was treated. He's probably one of the few, along with the others that made it from the Negro Leagues, that know what it's like to go on a, what they call, where you just kind of go on a tour of certain smaller cities and just play baseball, knowing you're not going to get rich, but you're playing for the fun of it and you want to entertain people. And then you get to the big leagues and it's like, oh, well, now you're important. Now, they were important before because they set a precedent. And the majority of white owners knew that. So Hank Aaron, for me, why he was really a hero is because he knew what he went through. He experienced that in the Negro Leagues, and then he made it to the major leagues and continued to excel despite the hate and the threats that were thrown his way. And I think that's – I wish somebody would have went back and talked to him. I'm going to have to look this up to talk to him about his experiences in the Negro League. That's what I'd love to hear about. I mean, granted, the major leagues is the creme de la creme, but the real ball players were in the Negro League.
As I was saying earlier, we're gonna, you know, we like to salute folks, and we love to give folks flowers when they can smell them. Not only what we do here, I think we should do that in life, man. You know, don't wait to go to a funeral to speak good of someone. You know, folks that have done some good things. It could be your family member, your friend, or whatever. Takes nothing but a few minutes or seconds to text them and tell them how you feel about them, what you appreciate, what you honor, how you feel, look how them in an honorable way. Take time out. Always take time to give someone some flowers. It doesn't really cost you anything. We salute and congratulate Jennifer King. Remember this name for a while. Jennifer King. She became the first black woman to be a full-time offensive assistant coach in the NFL for the Washington football team. When you stop and think about it, you may think, okay, what is that really saying? It says a lot to me. You know, we all grew up watching, and we still do watch plenty of football. And very seldom you see a woman on the sideline unless she's probably giving them some Gatorade or something of that sort. And this sister has elevated herself to where she's going to actually be calling plays, basically determining what's going on in an actual football game. For anyone that's kind of watched football the way that we have, we know that's huge. So we want to take a little time and kind of salute her. I'll come back to you, Mr. Charles. When you first heard of this, I'm sure I'm not the first one breaking it to you, but maybe some others that are listening, they're not aware. But when you first heard that she made it to this point, what were your initial thoughts?
Excited, a pioneer, prayerful. And I say that not to, like, to demean her or put her down or to act as if she's not credible. But we know in this game, particularly in a game like football with the type of owners that they have, that she's going to have to be, we used to say we had to be twice as good. She's going to be nine times as great as a woman, and particularly as an African-American, because you're talking about a so-called man's game and calling plays too. So I'm sure she would not have taken on the opportunity if she was not ready. But I'm going to be prayerful for her as well, because she's going to have to knock it out the box. There's not going to be any a lot of leeway for her, because as soon as something goes wrong or if we're on call, it's kind of like a lady umpire in baseball or whatever. They're going to, as soon as something goes wrong or a call was missed or whatever it may be, the critics are going to come out. So congratulations to her. But I want to see her succeed to show people that particularly in football, if you truly understand the game and what it is, there's a lot can be done on the sideline.
I'm going to commend her, but I'm going to commend the man that made it possible with her, Ron Rivera. And when you think of coaches, his name doesn't really pop up. But he had her when he was in Carolina. She was an assistant coach at that point, but she was on his staff. And he brought her to Washington recently, and then elevated to assistant coach position. And to me, that he deserved to be commended for that, because a lot of people were looked the other way. I remember Marvin Lewis. You know, Marvin Lewis never really won a, if I can remember correctly, never won a playoff football game when he was coaching for the Cincinnati Bengals. But Marvin Lewis employed a lot of other men that looked like him on the sideline. Now, Rivera is Spanish, so he pulled back and pulled his sister up. And that's what I tend to understand sometimes. I look at some of these coaches that, we want to see more black head coaches and more black general managers. And we're going to do something in that realm in a bit. But at the same time, when they get there, Are they bringing in folks and opening a door and allowing folks to walk in with them? And this is something Ron Rivera did. It's his second job coaching, and I'm happy to see that. Mr. DeMaurice, Jennifer King, when you came across the news and information that she was going to become the full-time office assistant coach with the Washington football team, you were thinking what, sir?
Excited at first, like Mr. Charles said, and then I had to think about the organization that she works for and how much trouble they have been getting into with relationships with women in their organization and lawsuits and things of that sort. So I don't want to take anything away from her and her abilities, but, you know, the second thought was, you know, could this be a play by the Washington football team to try to I know Coach Ron Rivera talked about changing the culture, and hopefully it's part of that change of the culture and not, you know, the owner who, you know, people dub as one of the worst owners in professional sports, trying to, you know, do the CYA kind of move, which CYA is cover your ass and say, hey, this is, you know, what we've done, and, you know, trying to take credit for things that we're doing good now, instead of and trying to hide the past of how women are treated in that organization. So congratulations to her. Hope she does well. I think that was an excellent response by Mr. Charles saying being prayerful, because she's going to need a lot, because I don't think that organization has changed a lot. I know Ron Rivera is doing a hell of a job changing the culture. Hopefully it continues to go in that direction. And who knows? Hopefully we'll see the first black female head coach. And if she's in line for that, you know, we'll be fighting for her to land a job and take one of these jobs in the NFL. Hopefully our owner is open enough and progressive enough to think that way.
I'll say this. In a league that's 70% black, bro, her problems should not be that many. Because if men that play in their lead are actually true men, they should not tolerate or see anything that's unjust to come her way. Now, I'm saying she may not face it, but they need to handle it if it comes that way, because what black players got to realize, especially in pro football, is you're the show. You're the show. You're the owners. But when they wake up and realize the show don't go on without you, it just doesn't. You take 70%, I'll knock the odds down. Take 40% of the black talent out of NFL, we're not watching. We're simply not watching. Alabama, if you even look at their team, the college football team from time to time, the majority of the players on that squad are what? And we know every time they're always ranked pretty high when it comes down to college football. So, again, it's time for them to wake up and realize, yes, she's made to this point, and if anything starts to kind of come slight of her, they need to be doing something about it. Stop being cowards and be men. Beast Mode Mala Agency just signed Najee Harris. Speaking of Bama, he used to play with Alabama as their running back. Beast Mode, you hear that name, Marshawn Lynch is the owner. And this brother's getting it done. You see him in TV commercials now. And I'll take you back real quick, because we want to salute him some too. Not that he need us, because he's been doing his thing. But remember when he was in the Super Bowl, Mr. DeMaurice, and they didn't go to him? And they wanted to really propel the Seattle Seahawks. They wanted to propel, at that time, Russell Wilson. And they chose not to really propel Marshawn Lynch, because they wanted Russell Wilson, what we all kind of thought was to win the MVP. And it's interesting how they're trying to hide Marshawn Lynch. And regardless of that, in my opinion, God has moved him up to the forefront. So when you look at him back then, what they were basically trying to take away from him and what he's been doing since then, how does that make you feel?
It doesn't make me feel any kind of way. Well, it does, because I remember that vividly, and I was watching it, and that brother, if you remember that game and that drive, he was willing them down the field. They were giving the ball to him, and the New England Patriots couldn't stop him. I mean, they just couldn't stop him, and it was a head scratcher when they went with the pass. And whether or not they were trying to hype up one player or the other, you know, they'll deny it. I don't know. But it just left a bad taste in my mouth, because You know, we're not big fans of the New England Patriots. We're not. And here you go, you see this game, and you go, okay, they're going down again. You know, I'm glad they're going down. This team deserves, this is going to be their second Super Bowl. They could have been, that single play of not giving them the ball on the goal line changed their destiny as a team. Changed the destiny of a team, because I think we were saying after that Super Bowl that the coach lost the team. I mean, you have one of the baddest teams in the NFL, the Legion of Boom, and you had an upcoming offense, an upcoming up-and-coming quarterback, and you had a running back who probably some people deemed as ghetto and, you know, and didn't want that image on you, but this was one of the baddest running backs that could not be stopped in the NFL. You knew that it was going to leave a scarred mark, but he recovered from that. He recovered from that to the point where, you know, they brought him back to the team after he left. And, you know, to see him what he's doing now, you can call him ghetto and all that stuff, but Charles said it best on our show last week, a sports show, that this is an intelligent brother, man. You know, I know he comes across like he's street and, you know, he's ghetto and all that stuff. But that brother, what really led me to believe he was really smart, when he went out the second time, they were interviewing him, he was giving advice to the young guys in the game. Like, take care of your body. Take care of your money. Take care of this. You know, you only last in this game for a certain amount of time. So he got a ring, and he's looking in retrospect and saying, you know what, I don't really have to be here playing football, but I got love for the game, and this is something I'm going to put, you know, money I'm going to put to the side to make sure I'm good when I leave the game. So to see what he's doing now and for him to be an example to other players, don't get me wrong, he didn't do everything right as a professional. He had some, you know, he had some missteps, but he seems like he's learned from them. He talks about his mother very, very often, about, you know, how big she is in his life and how, you know, she has a part to play in guiding him. So he has a good head on his shoulders, and he kind of psyched everybody out. Especially the press, of thinking that this guy is a wild card, he don't want to talk to the press, he's a bad guy. No, he's just not going to put up with the BS of the mundane kind of thing athletes go through. And he's taking care of his business, his brand, and everything else. I absolutely love Marshawn Lynch. I wish that Seattle would have brought him back. You know, I know the Raiders brought him in for a minute, but I wish Seattle would have brought him back, because they sure needed him. And they needed that leadership. He is a leader in that locker room, and he's a leader of men.
You know, it's interesting, man, because you kind of really spoke to it when you said the ghetto part of it. That's what they were trying to get away from. And they wanted to propel Russell Wilson. Take nothing away from Russell Wilson, but they wanted Russell Wilson to be the face of what they was doing. If he won MVP, they figured he would, you know, launch them, their brand. And he didn't see Marshawn Lynch doing it. And that's, in my opinion, why they didn't give him the football. But come to you in a second, Mr. Charles. I always remember this when he after that year, at the time I think he was residing in Oklahoma, California, and the cat one day, man, grabbed his bike and started riding through the hood of California and Oakland Park and try, and people from out of nowhere, man, grabbed their bikes and started following him. Think about that for a second. Then he went to the suburb, just riding his bike, and it's like there was no announcement, but he just let a trail. People just saw him coming and just got their bikes. They was talking about it. Come on, man. That's some love right there, bro. Marshawn Lynch has a marketing agency, and he's signing running backs, as we can see, Mr. Charles. I don't know. For me, man, I just love it, bro. Your reaction, your feeling, your thoughts.
Yeah, I'm going to go to that game first with the Super Bowl. Simply put, that was a bad football play. They had four opportunities to put the ball in the end zone. Four opportunities. It wasn't just one play. It was four opportunities. When you're in the red zone, you're that close, give the man the ball. They refused to do that, and they lost. In fact, to the point where New England was on the side looking like, oh, damn, we lost. And if you go back and watch that tape, you'll see the great Tom Brady going, oh, my God. And then they saw where they got the ball back, and he grabs his towel like, well, look at here. Look at this gift. Because they did not expect to win. But simply put, bad football play. Anybody that watches it knows it. Pete Carroll knew it too. So whatever you're trying to prove, it cost you a Super Bowl. But in regards to Marshawn Lynch, I think he's a crafty, clever individual. As Mr. DeMaurice said, he's had some missteps. I mean, who hasn't? It is what it is. But he's learned from those things. And, you know, he set a precedent when he said, you know, I'm just here so I won't get fined. And everybody's like, oh, my God, he's such a animal. He's such a bad guy. He's such a deterrent from the game. He's like, no, I'm just here. I'm here providing my contractual obligation because I'm tired basically of the BS that y'all asking. Same stuff over and over. And then, of course, he showed up, did his job. But the other part of it, too, is he's destroyed the stereotype of I have my hair a certain way, and I might wear a little scraggly beard, which means I'm ghetto fabulous, your interpretation, what you think. And he just has thrown that out the window because the way you wear your hair or the hairstyle you have doesn't mean that you're ghetto. A la Mr. Griffin, the quarterback, Griffin fan, and he's the quarterback for the Baltimore Ravens. So it's not about the hair. But with all that being said, imagine this. Marshawn Lynch was able to get an endorsement by eating candy before the games and doing it. Skittles was like, wow, you eat candy? Yeah, I love candy. Okay, well, he got paid eating Skittles and had a national campaign and probably got millions of dollars for eating candy because it was a thing to do. And then other people start eating candy. And I'm sure other people, their sales went up because Marshawn Lynch is eating candy at the Super Bowl. Imagine that. And then now he's turned it all the way around by connecting with younger players. And he's been where they want to go. So whatever he's working with or whatever he's doing on his own, when you had that experience, you're the perfect individual in a lot of instances to share that knowledge and guide the younger players a certain way. And it has nothing to do with color because he has the experience. When you play in the NFL, they don't say, are you black, white, purple, green, or are you Asian, whatever. It's like you are a top-notch running back slash fullback because you were Marshawn Lynch, not because you were African-American. So I'm sure he's going to get some other folks of different hues because of who he is. So with all that being said, he continues to make money, he continues to make waves, and I'm happy for him. I'm looking forward to see what his next project might be.
I love that Subway commercial, bro. That I do. Let's do a quick hit here, and then we're going to take a quick break. But a quick hit. Name a brother currently that's doing something that you admire, Mr. Charles.
Wow. Can you come back to me?
Absolutely, man. Mr. DeMaurice, name a cat that's currently doing something that you admire.
Yeah, I'm saying wow, too. And one's on the tip of my tongue, and I can't remember. I have to go back to the brother who opted out of the bubble who was going to play for the Lakers, Avery Bradley.
Yes.
Who opted out. And, you know, Lakers won championships. He's going to get a ring. But he opted out and saw what was happening in the WNBA and that they weren't being treated the same as the NBA players. And him and his wife just donated the salary and the money and everything to make sure that not only they were taken care of, but their children that they were bringing in the bubble were being taken care of. And so, that was the first person. I know there are a lot of other brothers who are doing a lot of other things in the league, and I can't remember right now, but I have to go with Avery Bradley. Nobody asked him to do that. He didn't go out his way. And then nobody really reported it. Nobody really reported it. You know, I didn't see in the big stations, you know, saying, you know, give him a pat on the back. This guy didn't have to do this. This guy didn't have to shell out the money. Here's something that the NBA is supposed to be doing. This is their league, and they weren't doing it. And he steps up and does it because he has respect for, what the ladies are trying to do in a pandemic, trying to entertain. So I got to give a shout out to him.
I'm going to say it's a cat, man, that no one's really kind of talking about. He was just named the defense secretary of this country a little while ago, man. Lloyd Austin is his name. This cat to me seemed like, man, you would not want to walk with him and face him basically in a hallway. It's just you and him. I gotta take him on, man. He's retired, but he came back. He always looked like
he's a big fella. Yeah,
yes,
big
sir.
Fella.
He's ready to go, man. I love it, man. I love it. I love it, man. It's like, you know, no, he's not gonna take any nonsense getting the job done. He's not gonna take any nonsense, and that's what I'm talking about. Mr. Charles, if you have someone, we'll take it real quick. If not, we'll take a quick little break. What you got, son? What you got?
Yeah, I want to talk about former NBA superstar, journeyman and superstar, Junior Bridgman. He bought the bankrupt Ebony magazine. He's bringing it back. He's been successful in so many other different ventures and venues, but he bought the rights to Ebony magazine, and he's going to put his all of his energy and money behind it, bringing back a strong, significant piece of the black press in America.
That's huge right there.
I'm glad
to hear that.
I'm glad, yeah.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Ebony was, man, you didn't go anywhere back in the day in somebody's house where it wasn't Ebony magazine laying on the coffee table, bro. Come on.
can I share one story?
Yes, sir.
I remember I used to go, I don't know if you, your mom or your dad, they used to get prescription to Jet magazine. I don't know who in your house.
Come on, man. I know where you're going.
And every time I came over your house, there could be a pile of them in the closet. They could be laid around. And I remember one time just laying them all out in the middle of the Jet centerfold, just looking at the centerfold with this Jet, you know. But you always read the Jet magazines. It's Ebony and Jet. I mean, those were the magazines that, you know, everybody had
that
Time, Life, and all that in other household. But in Ebony were our magazines where we saw, you know, us. And it was in every household. You saw a copy of those magazines, man. You grew up on those magazines. I'm so glad that he's stepping to do that. I am so elated that he's stepping up and doing that.
Yeah. Same here. Ladies and gentlemen, you see I can love these two gentlemen. Just think about this a second. They went from wanting to beat me up to only giving it 2 weeks, and this is what we're doing years later. Years later. This is what Black Man Talk. Mr. David Reeves, Mark Elliott, Mr. Charles. I want to go back into our personal history a little bit. As we move into the month of February, we know that Black history will be celebrated. But, you know, we all do our own personal thing of history. We all have our own personal thing that we have contributed and did. Could be in a small way, but it's ours. But I want to take it away from what we might have contributed. But something that may have happened in your life that kind of, in a way, defined the way that you are right now, Mr. Charles.
Wow. Probably losing my parents. And I say that because I lost my parents by the time I was 21, and I had to become very independent. And thank God my father gave me a blueprint to learn how to deal with life on my own terms with some help by others along the way. It made me very independent, and it also made me understand that if somebody couldn't help me or they said no, then my world would not end. And that's how I approach everything now. So if you can't help or whatever, and then I just have to get it on my own, I got to dig deep and do what I have to do. But then also to realize, too, that everybody's not like me and not on the same level in regards to my mindset. And I have to help others because they may not be ready for the challenge as well on a different level.
Mr. DeMaurice, something that kind of happened a while ago, it could be current, but it kind of played a role in defining your life some.
Man, I'm thinking about this. It's not like one thing. I know that my parents struggled, you know, with alcoholism. My mom struggled with mental health. And one of the things I was thinking about the other day is that throughout all that process, I had, before I even knew I had a biological brother, there were males who stepped up and became my brothers and still brothers today, even though they may be cousins, they may be friends, they may be sometimes an uncle or whatever, it was always someone that stepped up. And I think about, you, Mark. I think about my cousin Dion, who I lived with his brothers, Dwayne and Daryl. I think about my friends Eric and Scott. I think about, you know, Charles. You know, everywhere in my lifespan, there have been guys and men who have been closer than a brother. Even though I love my brother, these were brothers before. And I remember telling my brother, you know, when I met him, I'm like, you may meet some men in my life that have been closer to me than a brother. Don't take offense to it, because before I even knew there was you, I was the only boy in my family. I had three younger sisters and my mother's children. And so those men, uncles, cousins, friends, and men that I've begin to know, Wayne Salter, Daryl Bush, I can't name a David Donku from Ghana, Alfred Mayberry from Bermuda, all these men that I've met who have shaped my life, and watching them and us having these close bonds. Even the men that I've known, Sifu, Phil Nearing, who is my Sifu now, they have shaped me and helped me be who I am, and have been the supports for me when, you know, people have turned their back on me, things of that sort, and have helped keep shaping me and helping me be better. Instead of me going the other way and being, you know, an asshole to people, or vengeful, or striking out because I didn't get all the stuff that I thought I should have gotten, or instead of being scarred by, you know, being poor, not being able to get everything that I wanted or felt that I needed, or watching my mother go through mental illness and watching my dad go through alcoholism and coming out of it and all that other stuff. There was always somebody there who was like, okay. And one particular person, I have to name my Uncle Fred, Douglas Waddell, who said, you know, remember what you feel right now. Make sure your children don't feel the same way. So there was always some male figure and female figures, and I'm going to talk about the males today, who kind of stepped in, or not kind of, just stepped in and say, okay, hey, I got you. You know, you're all right. You're going to be, you know, I won't forget Eddie Kelly. And Jerry and Chris and all those guys, they just stepped in and became my brothers. And I remember sending a picture to my dad. It was me, Jerry, and Chris together at Jerry's when he retired from the Army. And I said, Dad, you met some of these guys, but you didn't meet all of these. And these are who were my brothers in college. These are my friends. And if anything happens, you contact them, because they know what to do. They will be here. And so, yeah, it's just those male figures that you meet, and they're still in your life today. And I don't care how long you go out talking to them. You pick up the phone, it's almost like it's yesterday. You talk to them, you can laugh and talk and joke or talk to them about something that's going on with you. And hopefully I have been what they have been to me. So there it is.
Great stuff there, gentlemen. Great stuff. Hey, I'm here again, and sometimes I sit back when we do this, man, and I'm in awe. I listen to you two and you two talk, and now I'll put a question out there, I'll throw things, and I'll be first to admit, man. I know, especially when we first started, some of the things that we talked about wasn't easy to kind of really just open up and share and talk, man. And I've always said this about what we're doing, in the sense, especially with men, for the most part, we're trying not to have a conversation, a deep conversation. You know, we try to keep it short. We try to keep it brief. And we're afraid sometimes to be vulnerable and just open up and just share and just talk, because we're not sure what we say, how it's going to be picking up, how it's going to be translated, how it's going to be dealt with. And I think that's the wrong approach, man. I think that, you know, no matter what you feel, don't care. Just say it. It's you, man. What you feel, be available to open and express it and say it. But make sure you're around people that can handle it, because everyone cannot handle you being that open and honest and direct. And I'm glad that, you know, for the time we've been doing this, man, we've been always ringing that bell and keeping that right where it needs to be. When I go back to my high school, like you two, I've had many I can choose to highlight. But I want to highlight this one because it was different in a sense. And I think back to my mother. As you know, Mr. DeMaurice, there was a school in New Haven, which is still in New Haven, was Hill House High School. And my two oldest brothers and sister went there prior to me, was scheduled to go there. And they all kind of bumped their heads a little bit, whatever the case may be. But my mother knew she didn't want me to go there. It could have been based on what they experienced, whatever happened, you know, whatever went on. But she knew that I was not to go there. And realistically, she wanted me to go to this full technical high school. And I had to fight against it. At the first point, you know, first thought of it, I was like, man, I don't really want to go. But, you know, I can't really say that to my mom. I just have to kind of, you know, she's guiding, I'm going to follow. But when it happened, partly because I knew my friends were going to Hill House. So when it happened initially, when I went there, I went to a school where it was predominantly white. Well, technical high school, good school, still around. And the school was predominantly white, and it wasn't that many of us. It just wasn't. Now, I didn't really experience any problems in that particular field of that happening, but it really, I was always kind of an independent person, but it forced me to be more independent and to rely on no one other than myself. And, you know, there's some, you know, you made friends there, you know, that look like me. I made some friends that didn't look like me, but it kind of pushed me away from my comfort zone for my friends. Now the guys that I was growing up with, I won't see them on the weekends, and that started to be less. And it kind of made me see things different. It opened my mind up in a lot of different areas and kind of view some things differently. But mainly, it allowed me to stand strong and firm on my two feet and to kind of feel that self-confidence and to build that self-confidence and look at things objectively. It kind of forced me, in a sense, being there. I couldn't kind of look at it from one side. It kind of opened it to kind of when I look at something, to see it in a roundness, all of it, and bring it all in, allow my mind to focus and think about it. So who knew my mother, I'm saying this, and who knew that in her mind, she knew by placing me there that would happen to me, you know, but she did make it clear that she wanted me to do something different. She didn't think that school was going to really help benefit me. And that's kind of how she kind of gave it, but she didn't have to say anything because if the mom chose me to go there, that's where I was going. But even if that was just her primary reason, I've gained so much more in those 4 years just being there. It helped develop a good portion of man that I am. Want to spend a little time talking about our natural way of doing things, in a sense. Because as men, our instincts is to fix stuff. We just are. Something's broke for the most part. And we may not know how to fix it, but we're going to try. We're going to try to grab a tool and try to fix something. And, you know, we want to, you know, we like for things to be broken. And I think that's due to our masculinity. You know, we don't really want to kind of, you know, have things that just aren't right. But I wonder when it comes down to basically, sometimes we've been in past relationships, or even now in speaking with someone, and we hear her venting, in a sense. And you listen, you think about it. In a sense, you know, we want to fix it. And I wonder why we want to fix it, Mr. Charles. Why is it that when we hear that venting, we want to jump in sometimes and start to fix it? And sometimes they just want to talk. Just want to yap. But our instincts says we should go in and fix it. And why is that? And is that the right thing to do?
Well, I think it depends on how you're raised. Most men that I know, you want to alleviate, if you have a mate, you want to alleviate the pressure or any issues they may have when you can. And therefore, serve as more of a calming option for them. Because some women can be very emotional. They can have things that really bother them. It can be the smallest of things. And then as a man, particularly depending on your experience, you want to calm them and soothe them. And you can't always fix it, but you can, I think, relieve the urgency of something. Because some people just, oh, man, it's an emergency. It's like, oh, my God, dude, somebody called me. The tire's flat. Oh, what are we going to do? I'm like, well, first of all, let's check out the scenario. But the point of it is serving as a calming influence on the situation for your mate or the individual that you're connected to.
Yeah, I think you do want to calm the storm, bring it down. But one thing that tends to happen, when you put out one five, there's another five tomorrow. It's fire. They just keep coming. The fire just keep raging, Mr. Big Reese. But I'll bring you the same question soon. When she's venting, or you experienced the venting in the past, why is it that we're, you know, prompt to kind of want to just kind of go in and kind of solve it?
Yeah, we're designed to be the, you know, the fire stoppers, the person that can help solve the problems. We think more logically. I was just talking to a buddy of mine recently, real quick, and he was he said he's been married for a long time, and I'm not gonna call his name, but he said that he got like cues where he could respond to a significant other like he's really listening. And he's learned the cues, like, to kind of chime in, which is really bad. But, you know, and we've all been there. We've been there. It's like, you know, here she go again. He's like, why don't you just shut the F up, you know? Well, he's like, he's learned over the years that, you know, he could say certain things like, oh, man, that's messed up. Or, you know, he can catch, you know, phrases and really? Wow. You know, he's just like he's in the conversation that he's listening. But she doesn't, he said, she ain't realized yet, I ain't listening. So, and there's a man for a while. So, what is that? So, I think sometimes, I've learned this, and I talked to other cats about this, is that sometimes we have to learn when she wants to just vent and when she wants, you know, answers to a question, and you have to listen very carefully to do that, because one of the things that he does, he said he gives her time, he gives her hours, like he knows it's going, he knows it's coming, so he sits in there that hour, and get everything that she got, and you know, and then go off and do what they need to, what he needs to do, what she needs to do, eat, conversation, movies, you know, doing that whole trying to relax. But I think sometimes we, you know, as men, sometimes we get in our own world. Sometimes we don't want to engage in conversation, maybe a hard day at work, maybe dealing with knuckleheads all day, that we want time to ourselves. So, but to really kind of listen to figure out the cues on when she really wants help, or asking, do you want my opinion? Or and sometimes this may get you in trouble. Do you want my opinion? Or, you know, are you venting and you just want me to listen? And then, you know, let me know what you want at a particular time. But I think that's more open communication, because you don't want to, you know, do anything wrong. But sometimes you don't even have to ask. You know your lady well enough to know, okay, she wants me to be quiet and listen and to be supportive of her right now, or she wants a conversation where we can kind of problem solve together. And let me temper trying to solve it real quick, and so it's not just my idea, but it's our idea that we're coming up with going through the problem-solving process. But it's a delicate balance, man. It's a delicate balance. You can't avoid it. It's going to happen every day, and you're going to misstep some days, and you're going to have to learn to say, you know, yeah, I was wrong, and just to get through the night. but it's a delicate balance, but it's one that you got to walk that tightrope. When it comes, when that situation comes, you got to walk the tightrope.
I the piggyback on your friend there, man. To me, when you said that, it brought me back to the years ago when I was married. And I don't know if I learned this from my dad without basically knowing it or whatever, but I swear, man, I could be sitting right next to you, or sitting when I should sit next to her. And I could tune out, and you think I'm there. You would think I'm there paying attention, and I am somewhere totally different. And he's right. You say some things or you whatever, and it serves that like you're paying attention, but it just gets you through it because, like you said, it's a delicate thing, because if you start to try to fix it, they may not want that, and that makes it worse. And if you don't, if you act uninterested, that makes it worse. It's like, at what point do you really kind of, and you really have to find a balance? It is delicate. My oldest daughter is interesting. And my sister that passed a little while ago was this way too. And there would be times on the telephone they would call. And I swear, all I have to say for 5 to 10, 15 minutes is, oh, yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, that's what I would have to say, because they would, and then would always crack me up, would make me laugh inside. Towards the end of the conversation, they would ask, oh, how you doing? And then shortly after, I say, I'm doing, we're off the phone. We're off the phone.
Mm-hmm.
We're off the phone. And it's just, I guess they needed the air at that time, whatever. But, yeah, some interesting stuff. In the past, Mr. DeRuce, have you caught yourself? And I think this is what makes it even more difficult sometimes. Have you caught yourself trying to repair someone else's brokenness? And if you have, why?
Repairing somebody else's brokenness. Yes, that seems to be the theme of my life. And why is because I got a big heart, and I don't like to see people in pain. And so if I can do something to help that particular person at that particular time, that's where I'm going to be, and that's what I'm going to do. So, it's my thing where, you know, if I see somebody in pain or I see somebody need something, I'm not going to let them go without. And that's the way my mother was, you know. She was that type where, you know, she didn't want you to be without. So whatever she had to do to make sure that you had it, she had a big heart. And I think I inherited that from her. So, I just hate to see people going without or in pain. And I'm always going to be that person that's going to step in and try to alleviate that. And if I can't, that's going to bother me. That's going to be to bother me. And then I got to kind of figure out a way to get you out of that pain, even if I can't help you.
Mr. Charles, the brokenness, sometimes in the past, maybe even currently, you try to help repair one that has brokenness. And if so, what brought you to that point?
Well, like Mr. DeMarie said, you don't like to see anyone in pain that you care about, somebody you love, or somebody that's close to you, because that pain can be reflected through you. It's like, well, if I'm connecting with this person, why, if I cannot do something to help them, why shouldn't I? And some things you can't fix. You just can't. But you can try to put them in a good place. Some things you can't fix. And then, two, if she was flying back in the day, probably got left. That's wrong. Anyway, I'm just kidding. Anyway, but if she was like, you heard me? Yeah. Oh, my God. What can I do to help you, girl? Anyway, that was a long time ago. If you're listening, that was a long time ago. But now it's all about helping the individual. You see them in pain and you because you care about them. But, especially in your circle, because that's the point of it is. And oftentimes I think that even if it's not, if it's somebody that's close to you and you see them in pain, sometimes you can provide even advice because they don't know how to deal with a situation. They're so caught up in whatever's bothering them, they don't even know how to move forward with it. And sometimes your perspective can go a long way to get them out of thinking of whatever, dealing with whatever they're dealing with, because they have not thought about it. They're so used to dealing with pain or what's the thing about doing the same thing over and over, which we know is insanity. They can't get out of their own way. And I think if you can provide some type of solution and they're in your circle, why not?
No, I think you two hit it really square. I'm going to take it a different approach to this, and it's probably not going to be like, that don't mean I don't take this approach. But I think that when you care for someone and you see them in pain, your initial reaction is to help. And it should be, because you care. You don't want anyone that you care about, even if you don't care about, you don't want to be in pain. But here's where I pull up, because I can try to help, but you got to do some work. The work has to come from you. Just because I can say some things, or I can offer or try to help, that doesn't alleviate or take away from what you have to do. And I've always noticed this, that some people are used to just being in pain, and they're so used to being in it to where stepping out of that pain is unusual, and it's not a move sometimes they're ready to make, and they're not used to it. So when I realize that could be the particular case, I have to move on, because I can't allow your pain to have an impact and push me into pain. So, yes, I'm always open to help out the benefit, but when I realize that it's a place where you're comfortable and a word sounds crazy to think about somebody with their pain, but that's how I look at it and that's how I perceive it. Because anytime you're not comfortable doing something, you should do something different to benefit and come out of it. And when you choose not to move forward, my stance is that that's where you're comfortable. And if I can't help you move there, I'm not going to consistently push to try to get you beyond. Because I still have to say, even though you're in your pain, I've been in pain as well. And that's how I like somebody to refer to my pain. I have to work through my pain. And we all have to work through our pain. But it's not incumbent on me to basically grab you and pull you out of it. I can only do so much. And if you're not willing to do your share, I must pull back. And hopefully in the process, I've said something or do something to make you see things a little differently. But I move on from there, because at the end of the day, I still have to preserve me. I just do. And like I said, that may not be liked about when people hear that. But at the same time, that's how I've been and that's how I've been treated. And that's all I would want. You know, I realize that I must, for the most part, help assist myself to be better and get to a certain point. I want to throw the word of ignorance and see how we can kind of look at this in a little bit, because to me, this is always on display in a lot of different ways. But I listened to a song the other day, and there was a phrase in there. Heard this phrase numerous times. Never thought about it, though. Just heard it, and I was like, this one time I was like, what the heck is going on here? But it says, to the heart and mind, ignorance is kind. And I was like, okay. All right, maybe that's why it exists so much. To the heart and mind, ignorance is kind, Mr. DeMaurice. When you hear that as a statement or just sung in a melody, and it sings, it kind of moves along. But to me, there's some relevancy there. True or false?
You got me on that one, bro. I'm still trying to figure out what that means. But I think that yeah, you got me stumped with that one. But here's my crack at it. I think it is kind to the heart and mind, because ignorance is kind of like you don't know any better. You don't know any better. You do something and you don't know. You just don't know. And if you just don't know, you just don't know. And maybe you're not punished as severely as if you're just stupid. Because my uncle used to say there's a difference between being dumb and stupid. Dumb is when you just don't know any better. Stupid is when you know better and you just do it anyway. And you should, you know, get the consequences. But that's the way I'm going to look at the ignorance part, is that you just don't know. And maybe life doesn't give you that big blow when you don't really know. And maybe you do get the consequences, but then you learn after that ignorant act that, okay, I didn't know, but now I should know better, and I could move forward better. But yeah, you got me stumped on that one. I hope I can answer. I hope I answered that. But you said, what song was that? I had to listen to that song.
What was it? It was actually Tamir was singing it, but it was an old, what's the guy's name? It came out, Careless Whisper.
Yeah,
it was right
George
in there.
George
Michael, you actually knocked that one out the park, man, believe it or not. You really did, because when you look at the word ignorant itself as a person, a state of being unaware, and that's it. You know, when you think about it, and why it's kind of kind is because it feels the norm. Even though you're ignorant, even if people that do ignorant things, for them, that's normal. It's like, you know, it's kind. It's what feels good to them. We look at it and we see it as being ignorant, but they feel it's kind because it's the norm. It makes them feel good. And it's a strange thing. Mr. Charles, I don't know if you want this, man. I hear you over there chuckling and all that, bro, but you got something you want to add. We'll bring you
well, on. I was chuckling for a couple reasons. First of all, I was chuckling because I was like, thank God he didn't ask me that question. I was like, what the hell? Anyway, because I know it. I think the word ignorance, I see it in a couple different ways. But I do recognize the factor that from the statement that ignorance is being unaware. So therefore, if you don't know, you don't know. And I'm with that. I think that's great. That's why it happens that way. A lot of people deal with repercussions. But I think there's another. I'm not sure if you're going to. Are you doing a follow-up question on this or no?
You know what? This might be it, man. I'm gonna, you know, from this, we're gonna jump into some questions from YouTube. But no, if you want to roll into it, go ahead, man. We got time, bro. Please roll.
No, it's not. I was just asking because I don't want to jump the gun. But what I was going to say though is, ignorance is a two-edged sword for me because you have people that are ignorant and don't know, and they might say something because they're lacking knowledge. But then you have other people that are ignorant that swear they know. As if they would swear to you, they know everything about something, and they look foolish because they listen to somebody, or they totally are oblivious and clueless to what the hell is going on. But you can't tell them that they're not right, and they will fight you to the end, even though they don't know what the hell they talk about. And I don't mean this in the everyday life. I mean this is in professional jobs.
Yeah.
In business. Literally. You're like, what? You're like, and then afterwards you go, you can tell you know the hell you're talking about. And you're costing losing money, losing deals, costing deals, the company deals, because you have no clue. But because you're such, these people are pompous asses sometimes. They think everything, they think they know everything, which is different than the other people who are ignorant because they just don't know. And they're like, oh, I didn't know. I thought it was. But when you have an air about yourself or an air about yourself and you come out guns blazing, yeah, so I think it's a two-edged sword. And I look at two different levels of ignorance, if you will.
No, I agree with you there, man, because what happens is people tend to follow ignorance because they don't know any better. And they're not individual thinkers. They're not smart. So they'll follow ignorance. We see this in the country. I see this in the country all the time. All the time. I'll be honest, man. I think half the Republican Party is ignorant because they all wait for someone to speak, and then they will basically break off from what that person say and then kind of try to sell it to you. They're not individual thinkers. And I'm not saying the Democratic Party doesn't have that either, but when I look around this country, I see that all the time, and you're right, there's different levels to it. There's people that basically will stand in front of you and act like they really know what they're talking about and try to sell you and have no freaking clue. But if it sounds convincing enough, even though it's ignorant, if it sounds convincing enough, people will buy in because they sometimes are looking to be led. Gentlemen, take a little break. We come back and get some questions. Mr. DeMaurice, Mr. Charles, Mark Elliott from Black Men Talk.
If you see a person that's asking for money with a sign or something, and you're walking past them, and you see them ahead of time, do you feel inclined to go in your pocket and provide them with change or some money?
Man, that's a good question, bro. Because I tell you, I wanted to say something about homeless because you figure this time of the year, man, this is when I see homeless people really hurts me because I it's cold outside. And I can't imagine not having a roof over my head and getting the heat. I love heat, bro. So I couldn't even imagine being outside and not be able to have a place to go get warm. Man. That hurts my heart. To say I'm inclined, yeah, sometimes. I will buy someone something to eat and I will do things of that nature and help out in that sense. I'm a little reluctant to give money to people that's holding the sign, partly because I feel like they may not be using the money for good use. I'm not sure how they're going to use it. So I'd rather do something where, like, if I've been in, you know, stations and places of that nature, and someone's been hanging around not too far, I ask them, "What'd you like to eat?" And I make sure I buy enough, not just for one meal, that they really can eat. And what I've always kind of noticed, to me, the ones that are really suffering in a sense, and maybe not have something that they're trying to really get, far as it could be a high or whatever, they're a little ashamed to come up to you and say anything, man. They really are. The ones that are more braggadocious, that stand and hold a sign, they're trying to feed something, bro. And it's not necessarily their soul or their body. They're trying to me, I could be wrong, they're trying to get high. So that's where my balance, when I come to that, when I see that, I'm not always ready to do that because, you know, they're looking to kind of basically, you know, take it and do something with it. There's one guy that walked up to me one day, and this white guy walked up. It wasn't too long ago. He walked up to me, and I was on the phone, and that's one pet peeve I have. I don't care what you are. If I'm on the phone, don't walk up to me and start talking. You see me on the phone, just don't do it. And you can wait, and I'll acknowledge you. You can ask what you want to ask me, but he asked, he said, my kids and family, blah, blah, I need some money. And I told him no. So he walked off, and he started swearing. Now, my initial reaction was to go say something. I was like, you know what, whatever he's going through, let him have that. And I walked away. But if you're pissed because you gave me some, could be a sound story about you and your family, what the case may be, and I didn't buy into it, that makes you pissed, then go on and deal with that. So in a roundabout way, man, yes and no, but I don't respond and give it to him based on that. Your response, Mr. DeBrees.
Yes, I do. And it was something that my grandmother told me a long time ago when she and I were talking about this. And she would put it this way, that sometimes the Creator tests you, and he'll place angels unaware to see how you would treat people. And it always stuck with me. And so if I have it, I'm going to give it. And it's not for me to judge, because that's not what the Creator told us to do, to judge other people. So whatever they're going to use it for, at least my heart was in the right place and giving it. And I too, I don't even like to talk about this, but I too have given folks, they're talking to me, and I'm like, you know, let's go in the store. You got kids, you know, they like this kind of cereal, some food, stuff like that. And, and buy it for them. At least they'll have a meal or a couple of meals, in that day, especially this day and time where, you know, people are really struggling. You know, you got the pandemic going on, and, you know, you don't know, you know, people are what situations people are going through. But yeah, I always feel that way. If I have it, you know, I'm going to do it and give what I have. In a non-judgmental way. So if they're going to use it for whatever they're going to use it for, it's none of my business. My heart was in the right place of giving. So that's all I can go on at that particular point.
Mr. Charles, your reaction?
Yeah, for the most part, I would say yes, I tried to. But I'm not going to lie, I had to assess the situation. I don't know what you want to call it, whatever the way I've experienced life. I watch and I see things around first. I try to assess the situation, and then I decide from there. But if you have a younger person that's younger than me, look like they're in great shape, and I'm like, what the hell are you doing out here? You know, I'm saying that to myself. And I'm not trying to judge, because you never know what's going on. But I assess that, and I try to do it the right thing. And then I also look at certain things. Like, I have to admit, I see people out there in the sign. I'm like, you know, there's temporary jobs out there available, man. Why don't you out here? You must be making a lot of money. You could get a job. But that's not my call to say. But I have given. I do give, but I'm not going to lie. I do assess certain things sometimes. And maybe that's just the human in me. But I don't mind helping people. I want to help them. But then, too, I just remember like it was yesterday when I was in a graduate school in college at Ohio State University. You would see guys out there, men out there homeless or whatever they were doing, asking for change or money. And I noticed something. It's like, is this a network? They would sometimes even switch ends, right? Be on one end one time, and they switch ends, but they never would cross each other's path. I'm like, well, you was here at 2 o'clock. Now 4 o'clock, you over here at the other spot. And I'm like, I know that's wrong. But I'm just like, damn, I'm a college student. But anyway, I need prayer, y'all. That's all I can say. I try, but I need prayer. But I'm skeptical sometimes. I'm just
I've noticed that network too, man. We have that here. Like you'll see them at one corner, and then the next day they're at another corner. And there's one cat that I haven't seen him recently, but he'll stand out there. He is dressed top to bottom with Nike gear, Nike sneakers on. Then he got a pit bull sitting next to him, and he's holding a sign. So maybe you shouldn't see him, Mr. DeMaurice, because you might just pull your pocket off, my brother. Your question you have for us, man.
I'm going to leave that alone. let's go on to mother figures. I was thinking about this from a previous show that we did. Mother figures that have come into your life, and how did they become your mother figure? And let's go on to that. Mother figures that stepped in your life outside your mother, but mother figures.
I don't have, other than grandma, man, I'm not a good person to answer this question because outside of her, I don't really have anyone. I can't really say, I mean, what I've experienced with other women may have been nice, but I never looked at them as a mother figure. I mean, they may have been older. They said some things, and I didn't cast them into that particular role. So I'm going to roll this one over to Mr. Charles.
There's been a few people. Like after my mom passed, my dad remarried, and there was a lady that she was like my mom. She really was hands-on with me, taught me a lot of things early on. But a few ladies in her family, it was like, I still call them aunties today. The only connection they had to me was through my stepmom. But they treated me with unconditional love, even to this day. And they were just solid people. And they always considered me to be my stepmother's son. She never had any children of her own. And even to this day, I see their children. It's like, hey, cuz, whatever. And that's genuine to me because they didn't have to love me. And I didn't belong to them. So those individuals there, really I kind of saw them in that light, and they had nothing but positive things to send towards me in love. So
those are those there. Okay. Mr. Reese, that's a good question, man. But, I mean, I have an aunt that is my father's baby brother. But even I never looked at her. I mean, I always looked at her as an aunt. I mean, I could probably, the closest, she might be the closest I can get to. But, I've always just seen her as that aunt, man, that was just caring and loving. But you sound like you have a few.
Yeah. One, I have to give her a name and then talk a little bit about her. Her name is Marcia Blue. And she's the mother of one of my best friends, Eric Gomez. And she lived right down the street from me, down the block, when I used to live with Grandma on Reed Street. And she has always been that kind of motherly figure. And Eric used to get mad. I never knew why. But he used to always say to me, my mom loves you more than she loves me. And, I was always thinking he was joking. But we've kept in contact over the years, and we'll text each other and talk. And she was revealing some things to me that I had no idea of, because I used to hang around at Eric's house a lot. And she said she admired me because she's like, Eric tells me, and she said, I've seen it, how you take care of your grandmother. And she was like, she kind of knew some of the things that I was going through. We would sit down and talk. I could stay over there at any time. And I was like the only friend of Eric's that could stay overnight that she would trust in the house. And she was telling me one time when I was telling her about what Eric used to say, and she was like, no, you know, she said, I look at you as Eric is the son of my blood. You're the son of my spirit, because we have so much in common. And she said, there was a time where if you were getting in any kind of trouble, you could have lived with us. And she said she brought that to Eric. And it was one particular situation where I kind of thought back, and me and Eric had talked about this. I remember Mark helped me get my driver's permit, and he had this bad Trans Am. And I remember asking him, can I take this Trans Am to the prom? And he's like, yeah. And then at last minute, I don't know what happened. Maybe you had a hot day. I don't know. But you're like, nah, I got the car. You can't take my car. So we were out. Me and Eric was supposed to go to prom. We were out without a car. We were sitting on his porch. He's like, listen, I'm going to ask my mom. And he didn't have his permit at the time. I mean, his license at the time. I had my license and everything. And so we sat there. We asked her. And she looked at me. And she's like, yes, on one condition. She said, Don, you are responsible. She had just brought a brand new Buick, brand new spanking new Buick Skylark. And she was like, the only one condition is, Don, you are responsible for this car. And we were taking the car from Friday to Sunday. And she was like, you're the only one to drive it. I don't care how much Eric begged or whatever. You are responsible for this car. And I expect it to be washed and gassed up when you bring it back. And I was like, wow, okay. But I remember talking to her about that years later. She was like, you were always the responsible one. And I considered you, you know, like my son, that I could really trust you in doing this, even though I'm not, you know, I was just one of Eric, in my eyes, I was just one of Eric's friends. But she was like, no, I looked at you as out of all his friends, you were the most responsible. So we went to the prom. We went to a picnic that next day, or amusement park that next day. Then we went to a picnic on Sunday, and I gassed up the car, washed it, and put it in the driveway, gave her her keys, and that was that. But over the years, you know, as a kid, not really knowing, you know, what was on her mind, how she felt about me and being an adult, and we talk all the time. I remember I was driving from North Carolina on my way back, and I was on my Bluetooth, and we talked for like 3 or 4 hours, and the trip was so much shorter, just laughing and talking about books we read, movies, things of that sort, our lives, her dating life, and all that stuff. I mean, when I say that I can talk to her about anything, I can really talk to her about anything. And it's just kind of amazing how the people that you grew up around, the adults, and how they kind of think about you and how they are looking out for you when you don't even know they're looking out for you. So I would have to say Marcia Blue was that mother figure that I didn't even know was a mother figure, but she was watching me and looking out for me all that time.
Ooh. It's deep, bro. Mr. Charles, you have another question, sir?
I'm going to defer to you. You hadn't asked us a question, sir.
Well, I've been doing all awesome, brother.
Now you know how I feel, right? Yeah, when y'all do that to me.
You like that? You like that, Diggory?
Yeah.
You like that? Look. I want the deep questions, brother. Come on.
Here's one. It's something that I wonder if this is in the back of my mind when we're kind of meeting, we've been dating, where the case may have been. I'll come to you with this question first, Mr. Joe. When you're dating someone, or in the past dating, because I don't know if dating even exists anymore, let's be honest, man. It's not like what we knew back in the day, and there's many reasons for that. Maybe that might be the next question, but getting to know someone, did that ever run across your mind in an initial, maybe even after knowing them for a while, you ask yourself, can I lean on this person if need be?
I don't really ask myself that question, because you'd almost have to damn near marry me for me to think that way. Only because I say that because I'm very independent. And not like I don't trust you, but I guess my point is, if I know that I don't think a person can carry the weight, why am I even putting them in that position? Then I got to go through the whole process of being frustrated, being mad, because they couldn't come through. So I think for me, it'd take a very long time, and I've been accused of that as well, as not trusting people. probably the wrong person for that to answer the question in such a way. But yeah, I wouldn't do that because I just don't, I'm so used to doing things by myself and doing for myself.
Okay. Mr. DeMaurice, in a point of things are going good for a while, does it cross your mind that you may wonder, you know, is this someone that if I needed to lean on, can I lean on him, on them?
Yeah, I'm a little different when it comes to that because in relationships, even when dating, I'm always assessing. I'm always assessing the person to see whether or not is this person long range or long term, or can they, you know, if we take this to the next level, what would it be like? Am I giving up too much of myself to try to fit in this person's world, vice versa? Do we have things in common? They're a night person or morning person. I'm always assessing to see whether or not this, how far this can go. And I try to make a realistic assessment and then analyze everything that I've gone through and say, okay, is this worth going forward? Or should we just break it off now and kind of go our separate ways and find people that are more compatible? So, yeah, I'm always in my mind thinking about, you know, whether or not this person is going to be the person that I can rely on or trust or all that stuff that comes with the relationship, because I'm constantly doing an assessment of that person to see whether or not they're my mate for life, or are they going to eventually become a friend, hopefully part ways mutually and be friends and not create another enemy.
Yeah, I know over the years that's something that inevitable that I would think about. And not that I would ever think that it need be, but I guess I would always want to know if it arose, if it came around and I had to kind of lean on you in some form or fashion, would you be there and you could hold the weight? Because I always felt like even if I'm with you, you can lean on me. And I don't never want to feel like that one time that it's needed that I can lean on you and you wouldn't be there. And if I realized that I probably couldn't, I'm not going to say I would shut things down or just go. I just know in the back of my mind how far I could take things with you, because I realized that, you know, if it need be, it's not possible. So, you know, that I would always be aware of. And I'm not saying that has to be there to in order to be with someone, but if it's going to be that long term, you know, and it's going to be wherever things you probably should go, I need to know that I can lean on you. I need to feel that. And your words don't say that. It's just something in you that will register with me. And I'll know. I'll know instinctively. And you feel it. And sometimes you don't have to go hunting for it, but it's there. I remember, I know I told this story years ago. I'm not saying this is part of the leaning process, but I know we're in winter now, and this pops in my head. I remember years ago when I was married, and this always just kind of runs in my head like a video, man. It was this woman that her and I went to school together, high school together. And she was a year younger than me in high school, so when I was a senior, she was a junior. But when I tell you, throughout school, we never even utter a word to each other. Not one word, not a hello. I say nothing, I mean nothing. Come to happen that at the time when I was living, she lived two houses down from me. And again, never said a word. Never said a word to each other. We'd come outside. We'd come out down our houses at the same time, walk down the stairs. Nothing. So one day, I'm going out, and it snowed. And not a lot of snow. Let's say 6, 8 inches, whatever. And I'm shoveling my car out. And she's outside shoveling her car out. And I think I got the back tires clean enough to I could move, and I, you know, jump in, and I go to take off, and my back tire, one of my back tires is spinning, and it spins, and I realize I gotta get back out, and she walks over, and she's been outside with no gloves on, none. I didn't realize this until she walks over. She walks over and doesn't say a word. And shovels that tire out. I stepped out of my car and my mouth just dropped. And I'm going to tell you this. the woman I was married to wouldn't have done that.
Wow.
Wouldn't have done it. Exactly. Would not have done that, bro. So when I tell you instinctively knowing about who you can lean on, there's a difference. I'm going to come back to Mr. DeMaurice. In a sense of dating, how has dating basically changed from maybe 10 to 20 years for you to maybe currently?
My discernment of who I choose to date, it can't be I'm looking at the overall person now instead of just looking at I put it this way. I remember a friend of mine on Twitter asked a question like, what would you tell your younger self? And I took a song lyric from Belle Biv DeVoe, like, you can't trust a big button smile. And I wish I had told my younger self that. Just because it's a big button to smile doesn't mean you got to go, you know, gung-ho and go after it. So, you know, just really looking at the whole person and getting to know the whole person before you kind of take a deep dive in, that's kind of different for me in dating. And then, you know, being serious about it. Don't do it for play anymore, because you could play with people's hearts, and I don't like to play with people's hearts. So that's a lot different than how I used to approach dating.
Yeah. Mr. Charles, yourself.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. How do you?
My
how is
that
dating? Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Unless you want to defer, you can defer again. But
no, I'm not deferring. Thank you, brother. not on this one anyway. It has changed from the standpoint of I think I would tell even my younger self, and something I would look at now differently, don't be afraid to be who you are and just roll with that, and that's part of it. I have to be concerned with myself and being confident, being strong in who I am and what I represent. Because when I was younger, that was a different issue for me, you know, in regards to trying to be something for somebody that I wasn't. And the other part, too, is, as DeMaurice mentioned, about finding out really about the whole and true person and being honest as to whether or not that person fits with your lifestyle and somebody that really is compatible. I know part of it, you have to have a sense of humor, a real sense of humor. You got to be able to laugh, things like that. Somebody that fits my personality, somebody that understands who I am as well and sees me for me. So it has changed dramatically. And I'm also probably more of, what's the word I want to say? I'm probably also more picky. That big button smile don't hurt no more. It's like after the first 6 months, you'd be like, oh, my God. What the hell am I doing? Anyway, you got to realize that you find something else besides that. There's a lot of very intelligent women out there with great physiques.
Yeah, I will say the big button smile has done a lot of brothers wrong over the years, bro. We got a minute to go before we kind of get out, and I'll just say this. I think, I could take a little bit from both what you gentlemen said, is that you kind of play down the visual a little bit less, not a lot less in a sense, and you kind of look at the person heart and their soul for me, and you kind of see that lines up to where you are, where you need it to be, and usually if it's not, you don't have time and energy for them. It's just that it doesn't feel right in your spirit, nothing feels good about it. Gentlemen, we'll get together soon. We know what's coming up soon with partaking that, but we'll get together soon and talk. And I appreciate what you two gentlemen always bring, what you always do. It's from Black Men Talk. I'm Mark Elliott, Mr. DeMaurice, Mr. Charles. Y'all take care of yourselves. Thank you.